Sometimes business news is easy, y'all. Two words, anti and trust. From American Public Media, this is Market Flex. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 24th day of October. Glad to have you along, everybody. One hates to rain on the grand mergers and acquisitions news of the day, that $85 billion offer from AT&T to buy Time Warner, but the markets would like to offer a word about that deal. That word is, Shares of ticker symbol TWX, Time Warner, dropped a hair more than 3% today, unusual to say the least for a company in receipt of a buyout offer at a 25% premium to its current stock price. There is, of course, a boatload of reasons that investors might not be wild about the deal, almost certainly not the least of which is the likelihood of extremely close regulatory scrutiny, a.k.a. the aforementioned antitrust. Catch is that in a media and political landscape changing as fast as this one is right now, answering that antitrust question is harder than ever. From New York Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going.
Beware anyone who claims to be certain about what's going to happen next. And looking at past events like AT&T's failed attempt to buy T-Mobile can be misleading. Christopher Yu is a University of Pennsylvania law professor.
This kind of merger is quite different from the AT&T-T-Mobile merger. In the AT&T-T-Mobile merger, it was a merger of direct competitors.
A.K.A. a horizontal merger. What AT&T wants is a vertical merger. It is a distributor of content, buying Time Warner, a supplier of content. It can be trickier for regulators to analyze a vertical merger, but the core question is the same. Does the combo harm competition? AT&T has to convince them that merging will be good for competition, or at least neutral. One potential argument is that by owning Time Warner's content, it's in a better position to roll out new video services people might like better than what's out there now.
By bringing both companies within the same umbrella, the combined company would be in a better position to experiment with different ways for distributing content.
Yu has spoken out for deals like this in the past and points to Comcast's merger with NBC Universal as evidence that a vertical media deal can get approved. But that was 2011.
The marketplace has changed since then. So the mere fact that a deal of a certain structure was allowed in the past, that doesn't mean that the same exact kind of deal would be allowed in the future.
John Bergmeier is senior counsel at Public Knowledge, a nonprofit that's often skeptical of big media getting bigger. And it's not just the market that's different.
The political climate has shifted. We've seen some very strong anti-merger rhetoric from all political quarters.
Not to mention growing public distrust of the media, which makes bashing a merger crafty politics. Add all that up and you have a stage set for a nasty fight around AT&T's bid to shack up with Time Warner. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
There's another deal in the works today, not quite as big, though. The discount brokerage house Scottrade out of St. Louis is being acquired by rival TD Ameritrade for $4 billion. It comes as increased competition and changes in technology, just like in media and telecommunications, are hitting the low-cost stock trading business. Marketplace's Adam Allington is on that one.
When e-trading took off in the U.S., the discount brokers with their smaller commissions attracted a wave of people who now wanted to play the market. By the late 90s, more than 20% of the population was investing in stock, compared with less than 5% the decade before, thanks in part to ads like this.
Go to Ameritrade.com.
It's easier than falling in love.
What do you feel like buying today, Mr. P?
Kmart.
So research it. All this stuff is provided for you free of charge.
No cost.
Yeah, that's synonymous with free.
But since the recession, investors are more hesitant to buy and sell individual stocks. They're turning to so-called passive products, such as index funds, which track the market. That slowly cut into profits as the number of client trades per day went down. Michael Wong is an analyst for Morningstar.
You know, in the old days, you could have clients with relatively little assets in their accounts, but if they traded a lot, they generated quite a bit of revenue for your business.
In reaction, Wong says discount brokers are shifting strategy away from commission to fee-based services, things like retirement planning and wealth management, almost behaving like a traditional bank.
You're seeing all of these formerly online brokerages that were arguably all digital expanding their branch footprint.
Which made Scottrade, with its 500 branches, a very attractive target for TD Ameritrade, says Gabelli and Company analyst Max Sykes.
They have similar clients, operations, their offerings, etc. It just made sense from a cultural pairing and also from an operational one as well.
Once the deal goes through, the combined company will hold more than 10 million client accounts and nearly $1 trillion in assets. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Wall Street today generally Did I? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are many, many ways to measure the tipping points in this election. Polls, of course, social media buzz as well. Also, market response to the political sparring of the moment. The moment in question for us today was the first Clinton-Trump debate and what markets were saying about it as it was happening. Justin Wolfers is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. He's out with a new paper about that night and the markets. Justin, good to have you back on.
It's a pleasure, Kai.
Take me back to that first presidential debate, a key moment in this campaign, 9 to 11 Eastern time. You are watching what?
I've got one screen watching the debate, another watching the prediction markets where people are betting on who's going to win the race, and yet another what's happening in overnight trading, watching the S&P go up and down as the candidates are speaking.
Well, what do you see on the S&P 500 futures?
Basically, every time you saw Hillary land a blow or Trump muffle an answer, you saw the stocks start to rise. And so through the course of the evening, between 9 and 11, they rose by nearly 0.75 percentage point.
It's a good thing you have graphs, honestly, in this paper, because there's lots of formulas, but the pictures tell a story. It's quite the, you'd call it a spike.
It absolutely spiked, and it wasn't just a two-hour spike. We were looking minute by minute, and for instance, when Hillary took Trump to town about not paying taxes, which was a moment that scored well with most audiences, it also scored well with the stock market. The S&P started to rally yet again during each of those little phases as well.
It's important here to note the historical context in which, well, first of all, this whole race, but that's an entirely different interview. But this issue that you're looking at, you went back in history to see where Republicans and Democrats sort of fell out in terms of this kind of movement.
Yeah, so it's usually the case that if you look at what happens when there's good news for Republicans, it's more likely we get a Republican president, usually Wall Street cheers. It might be they prefer Republicans as economic managers, or it might be they think they're going to get a tax break from Republicans. I'm not sure what it is. But we've looked at this for pretty much every election since 1880. And to see Wall Street cheer when a Republican becomes less likely to win, that's extremely unusual. And then the size of the movements this time, it's just much, much larger than they typically are. Usually, Wall Street doesn't care that much about elections. This time, they think it's a really big deal.
Take me away from equities for a second. You guys looked at foreign exchange. You looked at the currency markets, too.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. So, first of all, the peso has basically become a bet on the future of the election.
Right.
And so, you see this every time there's any interesting political news right now. If it's bad for Trump, it's good for the peso. If it's good for Trump, it's bad for the peso. But we actually extended that and looked at a wide range of currencies. And what you see is the currencies that are most sensitive to Trump. It's not just the peso. It's also the Canadian dollar, the Aussie dollar, the Korean won. These are countries where the U.S. has free trade agreements with those countries. And so you see a lot of concern, I guess, among those countries that are tightly economically integrated with the U.S.
There is a correlation is not causation poke in the eye to be had here for you. I mean, you know, give me that analysis.
This is where it's really important. We're analyzing a period where basically nothing else was going on. And it's a very large movement, and extremely large for 9 o'clock on a Monday night. And the fact that the markets rose pretty much in parallel with Hillary's chances, and the fact that the peso rose at the same time, pretty much tells you this was a political shock. It wasn't something else.
There will be those listening to this interview who will say, ah, lefty academics, they just want Hillary to win, and that's why they're doing this.
That's a totally reasonable argument if this were an argument from a lefty academic. What I'm doing here, Kai, I'm just the interpreter. It's the market saying this. I am just telling you Wall Street rallies when Clinton becomes more likely to be president. So this isn't what my liberal friends are saying. This is what my investor friends on Wall Street are doing.
Justin Wolfers is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. His paper is called What Do Financial Markets Think of the 2016 Election? We've got a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Justin, thanks a lot.
A pleasure, Kai.
With the president out on the campaign trail for Hillary Clinton this week, Obamacare is getting more than its usual set of mentions in stump speeches, both Republican and Democratic. If you think back 5 years, though, to the days of the debate over what would eventually become the Affordable Care Act, you'll remember a big catchphrase that supporters used. It was bend the cost curve. That is, slow the increase in health care expenditures. One of the ways law tries to do that is with something called accountable care organizations, when doctors come together to take responsibility both for the health of their patients and for how much it costs. In theory, patients have better outcomes and doctors make more money. So from the health desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports that at least some of the time, that theory holds.
Millard Scott is as thankful for everybody's help.
I got more help than most people in the United States has got.
As the chronically ill 76-year-old is sick.
They have taken me to the hospital sometimes. I didn't think I was going to make it.
COPD, or struggling to breathe, is Millard's big problem. Last year it got so bad you could have just called him Mr. Saturday, since that was the main day he kept showing up at the ER.
He was going sometimes 2 to 3 times a week.
That's Millard's primary care doctor, Dino Beckett. This year, Beckett joined in with a handful of other primary care practices in West Virginia with the hopes of giving better care while saving money. And because of this accountable care organization, he can now keep tabs on his patients, so he knows how often Millard goes to the ER and how much he cost. When the ACO launched, Millard was his 13th most expensive patient. Medicare had spent $36,000 on his care the year before, most of that for the ER and hospital.
What we're trying to do is really just change the mindset and allow patients to understand that they have access to us.
Beckett's increasing that access by hiring a team of community health workers, including nurse Samantha Runyon.
How are you doing?
Runyon is doing her weekly checkup on Millard. Her job is to get to know patients like him, understand their lives outside the world of healthcare, and try to keep them healthy. Beyond being super sick, Runyon had a hunch there's something happening under the surface. It took her 4 visits to figure out what.
So I get down there, and I go in, he's kind of struggling breathing. I said, well, what's happened to you today? And he's like, well, I've got up and I've had a bad morning.
Millard lives in his daughter's house, and he told Runyon he felt bad because he'd spilled a cup of coffee. Runyon realized even something that may seem small could trigger his COPD. He's got anxiety, and that just makes his condition worse. So she and Dr. Beckett hatched the kind of plan you would rarely see a few years back. They made it easier for Millard to see his doctors, to get care at the hospital. And on top of Runyon's weekly visits, Beckett says he makes sure Millard gets a call every Friday.
There's so much more interaction. Now we're reaching out to him to try to head off situations that could be very ominous for him.
And I felt that I could talk the way I wanted to talk.
5 months later, Millard feels better. His doctors say they've avoided a couple dozen trips to the ER, and Millard has gone from the 13th most expensive patient to the 30th, on track to spend $16,000 less than last year.
That is a wonderful story. We have saved money. We have improved somebody's health.
That's Harvard economist Michael Chernew. He says, though, these ACOs may not actually save that much money.
When you add it all up, it ends up being less dramatic than sort of the best-case scenarios that that story represents.
When ACOs hit the scene around 2010, people had hoped they'd cut spending by 30%. The best data show they've saved more like somewhere between 2 and 10%, primarily because hands-on care isn't a cure-all. But experiences like Millard's are teaching us when a patient has someone they can trust, a nurse, a home health aide, someone like Samantha Runyon, change can happen. Millard sees it.
If I know she's coming, I can sit here and make it through it.
Millard says the truth is, without Runyon, he'd land right back in the ER. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
For me, this light bulb went off where I realized, wow, other people can be entertaining.
YouTube is more than just cat videos, you know? CEO Susan Wojcicki, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 77 points today, 0.4%, 18,223. The NASDAQ gained 52 points. That's about 1%, 5309. The S&P 500 up 10 points, 0.4%, 21 and 51 there. AT&T and Time Warner, we told you about. AT&T down 1.6% today. Time Warner down 3%, a hair more, actually. All of that could be good news for T-Mobile, though. Its CEO says it's going to be a great time to grab market share. What with AT&T being all tied up with the deal and everything, T-Mobile also had a strong earnings report today. That always helped. Shares up 9.5%. Tis the season of big mergers. Today, one is taking flight in the aviation space. Aircraft component maker Rockwell Collins is going to acquire BE Aerospace in a $6 billion deal. BE is the world's biggest maker of plane seats. Also makes those mystifying vacuum plane toilets, too, in case you ever wondered about them. Anyway, Rockwell shares sits in turbulence down 6.2% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. No cracks about pandering to pop culture with this next story, all right? Because it is totally about business, to wit, Taylor Swift. The country turned pop singer turned megastar is now 26 years old, which makes it kind of amazing that it was on this day 10 years ago that she dropped her very first album, the self-titled Taylor Swift. Her success since then, you are probably aware of, topping out this year on the heels of her recent world tour with the number one spot on Forbes' highest paid celebrities list at a cool $170 million. Along the way, Swift has developed and is not afraid to use some serious business expertise. From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Swift got a superlative start. Both parents come from the finance industry. They saw she had promise, moved to Nashville. And, according to Stephanie Keller, marketing professor at Berklee College of Music, she got the very best training in artist development. Also, says Keller, Swift has innate gifts.
Her business acumen, gleaning what was going on around her as a young teenager, and then pick up that ball and run with it.
From the mid-2000s, that's the internet, online video and music streaming, and especially social media.
She has been able to step in where there's a new technology, figure out how she wants to stand in it at the leading edge.
Gigi Johnson directs the Center for Music Innovation at UCLA. She gives an example with the latest album, 1989, the song Blank Space. And with the song, Swift released a 360 video that included
hidden messages. So she played with it with her audience. It was something that was kind of a treat, something that was like an intimate look into her life, which goes totally with the way she runs her brand.
She's also turned that brand into a force in the music industry, says Keller. Swift has pulled her catalog from streaming service Spotify, and when Apple wanted to offer music for free during an online promotion,
Taylor stood up and said, no. The artists deserve royalties. She has an enormous voice, not just her singing voice, because she does speak up and she does push back.
And it sure hasn't hurt her image or sales of her singles and albums. Swift's young fans like that she stands up for herself and other artists. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A couple of weeks ago, I was at a conference up in Menlo Park, a town smack in the heart of Silicon Valley, doing one of those conversations on stage in front of an audience. I was talking to Susan Wojcicki, the CEO of YouTube. Google bought that company in 2006 on Wojcicki's recommendation. She has been running it since 2014, and we're going to pick up our chat with her talking about when she realized what a video going viral was really all about.
Then we actually had our first hit.
Yeah.
And our first hit were these students, these Chinese students, in their dorm room singing to the Backstreet Boys, and they have their roommate in the background doing homework. But they're so funny that everybody watched it. And so, you know, for me, this light bulb went off where I realized, wow, other people can be entertaining. Lots of people out there can produce content that other people want to see. And there's actually something really human about the fact that so many people want to express themselves and have other people enjoy that. And that was a light bulb for me that made me realize that video and the technology enabling anyone to create video was going to be really powerful.
Talk to me for a minute then about original content.
Yeah.
And because you got to get there in a substantive way, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have started doing original content, like everybody else. Yep. Our YouTube originals are focused on YouTube stars. And so, like, PewDiePie, who's our largest creator, he's a Swedish.
Swedish guy, right.
A Swedish guy. And he plays games, and he talks over the games. He narrates the games. So he did a show called Scare PewDiePie, which was something different than his regular programming. What we did was he was actually doing real-life game and challenges.
So you went to him and commissioned this, and you said, hey, listen, PewDiePie, we have this idea. Let's work together on this thing.
Yeah, so we have been doing that. We will have ideas, or we'll buy content from other producers. Sometimes our creators come to us and they say, I've always wanted to do a movie. Right now on YouTube, I do this daily vlog, but my dream is to do a movie about this. And so it's worked really well, where our creators have actually seen that has helped them get more adoption on the YouTube platform, because we have some additional shows that are higher end from them.
There's a question to be asked here about this place, Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
What it has come to mean in this economy and this society.
Yeah.
And every single article about you says, Susan Wojcicki was in Silicon Valley before it was Silicon Valley. You're born and raised here.
That's true.
High school here. I mean, the whole deal.
I did.
So the question is, what do you make of what this place has become? When you look around at Silicon Valley, for all the goods and ills.
Yeah. I mean, when I was growing up here and I went to high school, we used to always talk about how we were going to leave, because there was nothing to do. And I remember in our high school paper, we wrote this article about what are things that you can do after 10 in Palo Alto. And one of them was going to Safeway. another one was going to Denny's. The fact that there's so much transition that's happening, there's so much change in the world, and a lot of it started here. And wherever you go, you see people on their cell phone, and I see them using Google products, and that's really, that's an honor. It's great to see the impact that we can have here with technology, and the responsibility that comes with that.
This isn't my original thought, but it's in a lot of the reading that I have done about you. YouTube is a cultural force in this society. Is it, though, an economic one yet?
Well, you know, economics, and especially digital economics, they take time to develop. We look at our numbers, and some of the numbers that we've released, for example, is we've paid out over $3 billion to the music industry, for example. The number of creators who are generating six-figure incomes is increasing by 50%.
Think about that for a second.
So we have
YouTube creators making six-figure salaries.
Yes. I mean, we have creators who are making more than six-figure salaries. Yeah. More. So it depends where you are on that spectrum. This is the new form of media company, right? Individuals who have a skill, want to be an entertainer, want to do how-to, and then they get enough popularity that they can actually go out and hire staff and do this even better.
There will come a time.
Yes.
At some point, where Sergey and Larry and the folks at that level of Alphabet aren't going to want to do it anymore. There's a fair bet that they come to you and say, hey, Susan, you're going to run this whole thing. Is that attractive to you?
Well, first of all, I don't think that's going to happen. I've known them for many years. I think they enjoy what they're doing, and I think right now they're in a position where they actually get to re-innovate, right? They're in a position with Alphabet to be able to focus on all these new companies and these new bets. Sundar is running Google. But if they did, then probably I'd say yes. I don't think that's in my future. I think they're going to be at Alphabet. I think they enjoy Alphabet. I think they like to create. And I think we're going to see a lot more exciting innovations out of them.
Susan Wojcicki, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
We talked about 45 minutes all told, she and I did. There is lots more to hear. Her thoughts on art and technology, for just one example. Check it out. It's the latest episode of our Corner Office podcast.
This final note on the way out today, filed under the Too Much of a Good Thing tab. General Mills is apparently teaming up with the Girl Scouts to make cereal versions of two Girl Scout cookie varieties. Thin Mint is one. Caramel Crunch is the other, which is supposed to be Samoa's, I guess. On store shelves in January. I don't know. All right, we got to go. But seriously, first, check out the rest of that Susan Wojcicki interview. She was real thoughtful about a whole bunch of things. The Dow up 77 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 52 points, about 1%. The S&P 500, 10 points to the good, 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Gurova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.